Well, as I mentioned earlier, we come to this great subject this evening from the book of Proverbs, this subject of self-control. And I doubt there's any of us here this evening who feel that this is something that we've got entirely sorted, that we are in absolute control of everything and nothing happens that is outside our control. And one of the great ironies of life, isn't it, that there are many people sometimes described as control freaks, always trying to maybe interfere a little bit and control the things that are going on around them and even the things that other people are doing. But here's the great irony, that for many people, the biggest thing, the greatest problem that we have in controlling are not things outside of ourselves, but it's actually our own hearts, our own will, our own emotions, our own mind. The most difficult thing to control of all is ourself, isn't it? That's the hardest thing of all. And the Bible is very honest with us about this. It's one of the great things about the Bible. It's always honest with us about our problems and about our difficulties. It never pulls its punches. And the Bible tells us up front that you and I have got a great problem with self-control. Do you remember one of the verses that we read from the book of Proverbs earlier on, Proverbs 23 and verse 19 on page 579? Particularly maybe on a Sunday evening, maybe some of you can relate to this more easily on a Sunday than you can on other days of the week. Proverbs 23 verse 19, "Hear, my son, and be wise. Guide your heart in the way. Do not mix with winebibbers or with gluttonous eaters of meat." Does that describe any of your lunches today? It would normally perhaps describe mine, but Sharon's visiting her sister this afternoon, so I didn't get any meat at all, I'm afraid, for lunch today. But look at verse 21. "For the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe a man with rags." And it's clear what the writer is saying, isn't it, as this proverb is put together. If you consume too much wine and too much food, then very quickly you'll get tired and you'll probably become overweight. And as a consequence of that, you won't have the energy that you had before and the things that maybe you used to be able to do and you'd enjoy doing and will be good for you, you won't do any longer. And this problem will beset you. It will end up clothing you in rags. It will be your downfall. Now, that's just one of the examples that we have in the book of Proverbs. It certainly isn't the only example. Don't feel that I'm picking on particular groups of people this evening. I'm not trying to do that. Look at Proverbs 18 and verse 7. "A fool's mouth is his destruction, and his lips are the snare of his soul." So for other people, the issue of self-control is not so much what goes in. The problem of self-control is what comes out. Maybe that's more of an issue for you. We're all different from one another. Maybe you can see the wisdom of Proverbs 21, verse 23. "Whoever guards his mouth and tongue keeps his soul from trouble." And maybe you're somebody who hasn't or finds it difficult to guard your mouth and your tongue, and you end up saying things that you regret saying. You're not able to control what you say. And as a consequence of that, you get yourselves in all kinds of trouble. Has that happened to you? Are the regrets looking back in your life about things that you've said that you wish you had never said? Maybe in a moment, anger flared and you blurted out something that you could never undo. That's many people's experience, isn't it? So for some of us, the problem of self-control is what goes in. We don't control what goes in, whether that's food or whether that's things that we watch or things that we read. The problem is the things that go in. And for other people, the problem is what comes out. Maybe angry words, maybe violence, maybe selfishness, whatever it might be, but we can't control it. And the book of Proverbs tells us that. It tells us that there's this great problem. As I've been looking at this issue, there was one particular author that was helpful to me. I need to acknowledge him for his sake as well as for mine. His name's Tim Keller, and those of you who have been looking at On the Growing Together course may remember that we read a book recently written by him, and he's written helpfully on this subject as well. And he, in one section, defines self-control like this. If you think, well, what is it that we're really talking about? Here's what self-control is. Let's see if this definition describes you and describes me. Here's what he says. The definition of self-control is the ability to recognize and choose the best and the most important thing. The ability to recognize and choose the best or the most important thing at any given moment. And the problem is that very often we make those wrong choices, don't we? And very often the wrong choice is not just because maybe sometimes we don't know what the right thing is. Maybe sometimes that's the problem. But very often the problem is that we don't want the right thing, isn't it? What we know to be right is something we don't actually want. And sometimes we go after our desires instead of what we know is best. And if we were self-controlled, we wouldn't do that, would we? If we were self-controlled, we'd recognize what was best. We'd recognize what God wanted for us, and we'd choose that, rather than choosing the thing that seems to build up and eventually overwhelm us. So maybe for some, to pick up some of the themes that we've got from the book of Proverbs, for some, maybe that's an urge to eat things that you know are unhealthy. And still, we know it will be best, and you know me well enough to know that I speak from personal experience in this regard, at least. It would be best to say no to pancakes or donuts or whatever it happens to be. But the smell and the sight and the imagined taste, well, sometimes maybe becomes overwhelming. We just need to be able to say no. And maybe for others, it's maybe health. And maybe we know that we need to take exercise or we need to cut down on certain things in order to be healthy. We know that's the right thing to do. We know that's the best thing to do. And yet still, we struggle and we don't say no and we do the things that we ought not do. I was talking to someone just recently who has type 1 diabetes. That's the much more serious type of diabetes that can be fatal. And when he was first diagnosed, for many years, he didn't listen to the doctor's advice. And he knew, in a sense, what was the right and the best thing to do, but maybe lacked the self-control to be able to put it into practice. Or maybe your tongue is out of control and you lash out and you become angry unnecessarily. And as a consequence of that, all kinds of other things suddenly start going out of control, doesn't it? You shout at someone who maybe doesn't deserve your anger. You say things that really you regret saying. And suddenly that relationship, maybe it was a good relationship before, and the friendship is lost and the relationship is broken. And all kinds of other things start to spiral out of control. That's the problem of self-control. The problem is it's very hard to do, and it has enormous consequences when we fail to do it. And that is the perfect storm, isn't it? Something that's very hard to do, to be self-controlled, and something that can have terrible consequences when we fail to do it. And maybe for others, it shows itself in other ways. I've talked about, for some people, it's the problem of what goes in. For other people, it's the problem of what comes out. Maybe for some of you here this evening, you actually do quite well with both of those situations. But for others, you know, there's also the problem of what goes round and round. And we're not self-controlled in how we think. And maybe for some, it's question of anxiety, perhaps, and these anxious thoughts go round and round, becoming more and more fearful. Or maybe for others it's jealousy, and maybe for others it's this impulsive nature that we have, and we just do one thing and after another, and we're out of control. It's a real problem, isn't it? And you remember that verse that we said earlier on was at the very heart of our topic this evening. Proverbs 25, that was, and verse 28 on page 582. Because here really is a metaphor that the Bible is using that is tremendously helpful in helping us to see the problem of self-control. Whoever has no rule over his own spirit, we read, is like a city broken down without walls. Now, maybe the picture doesn't work quite as well in the 21st century as it did in the 9th century BC when Proverbs likely was written. But you can imagine quite easily, can't you, in those times, a great city, probably on a hill, maybe a city like Jerusalem. And here is this city, and around the city are these great walls. What are the walls for? Well, clearly for protection, aren't they? They're there to ensure that marauders don't come in and steal all the food from the market. They don't come in and cause havoc and violence. That's what the walls are for. They're there to protect you. Well, what if you were in a city, as Proverbs 25:28 says, the city broken down? Imagine the city of Jerusalem when Nehemiah arrived. Can you imagine that? And he arrived in Jerusalem and found the walls were broken down. Do you remember what he did? Do you remember he broke down and wept at the seriousness of it? Because they had no defenses against what was coming around them. And he made it his number one priority to build up those walls. Why? Well, without the walls, then disaster was just waiting to happen. That was the problem. And if you have a problem with self-control, then you're a disaster that's waiting to happen. And at the moment, things might be okay. Jerusalem was kind of okay for a little bit. But sooner or later, the problem will come, and it'll be a disaster waiting to happen. Self-control is a must if we're to get anything out of this life at all. So, that was the first point, really, of tonight's message. The problem of self-control. It's a great problem. It's a problem that we all share. For some, the problem is controlling what goes into us. For others, the problem is controlling what whirls around inside of our minds. For others, the problem is controlling what comes out of us. But for all of us, we've got this great problem of self-control. Well, it's all very well to be told what the problem is, but we want a solution, don't we? What's the solution to self-control? Well, here's my second point this evening. If the first point was the problem of self-control, the second point is the practice of self-control. And I want you to understand something very important right at the beginning, because we need to make sure that we're honest with ourselves as we think about the practice of self-control. Because there is a lie that goes around. And it's a very prevalent lie. It's a lie that you'll hear often. And it's a lie that some of you have spoken and probably all of us have thought. Here's the lie. The lie says that sometimes we have no choice when we do the things that we do. That's the lie. Sometimes we have no choice. Have you ever spoken to somebody, maybe, who has fallen in love with somebody else, maybe somebody who was married, and the whole thing's been a great disaster? And what's the excuse that very often they put forward? Well, here's the lie. They say, I couldn't help it. I fell in love. There was nothing that I could do. Well, we need to know that that is a lie. Most famous theologians over the last few hundred years is a guy called Jonathan Edwards. He's written a book called The Freedom of the Will, and that's what this book is all about, helping us to understand that there is never a situation when we're not involved in making choices about what we want to do. You see, sometimes we make the mistake of setting up, as it were, our emotions against our will. Our will are the things that we choose to do. So we choose what we might have for breakfast. We choose what we watch on television. We choose where we might go for the day. Those are the choices we make. But then we say there are other things that kind of happen to us sometimes, our emotions. So have you ever said this? He made me angry. She made me angry. Have you ever said that?
Yeah.
That's the lie. That's the lie. All right, we've all done it. Maybe only one is willing to admit it, but we've all done it. We've all done it. She made me do it. He made me do it. It's a lie. We chose to become angry. Maybe the other person made it easier for us to make that choice. But nonetheless, it is still a choice. We chose to do it. The things that we said in our anger, we chose to say. And maybe afterwards when we try to apologize, we say, well, we didn't mean it. But the problem is, in the moment, we did mean it, didn't we? And we chose to say it. That's why it hurts so much. That's why it's so destructive. We choose to do it. We say that we can't stop, but it's our choice to carry on. And we need to understand that. And if we keep on that lie, then we will never ever succeed. We will always fail to be self-controlled. We must take responsibility for our actions. Now, I need to be clear. There are obviously certain things that do happen to us. If somebody punches me on the nose and I get a bloody nose, then clearly at that stage, that's something that happened to me. I'm not to blame for that, all right? But if I punch back, or if I'd maybe said something in the first place to provoke it, then maybe that would be a different situation. There are things that happen to us that are outside our control. It's important that we understand that. And maybe for some people, terrible things happen to us. And we ought not take the blame for things that happen to us. The people who do those things must take responsibility and must take the blame for things that happen to us. But we must take responsibility for the way that we respond. We must take responsibility for the things that we do. So that's the question we need to ask ourselves. Is this something that I did? Well, then I must take responsibility. And if I said something or did something, if it was me doing it, then I take responsibility. I can't blame others. I can't blame God. I must take responsibility for myself. And if we refuse to do that, we will never, ever be self-controlled. Let me give you a couple of biblical examples of people who are self-controlled so we can see how this works. They're very well-known examples. Let's go to Genesis 39, first of all. You don't need to turn to it. You know the story very well. It's the story of Joseph. In case you don't know the story, Joseph had been sold into slavery by his brothers. He ended up working as a slave in Egypt. And there, as he was in Egypt, working as a slave, the master's wife took a liking to him and tried to take him into her bed. And this is what happened. It says that she spoke to Joseph day by day, but he did not heed her. And then one day she caught him by his garment, saying, sleep with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. It would have been very easy, wouldn't it, for Joseph to be able to say, well, she made me do it. She came on to me time after time. She ground me down. Those things were true. But it would not have been an excuse for Joseph. If he had done what she had wanted, he would have been in the wrong. It would have been sinful. So what did he do? He fled and ran outside. That was the right thing to do. That was the actions of a man who was self-controlled. Let me take you to another example. This is 1 Samuel chapter 24. And this time we're looking at David. Now, David at this time was not yet the king. David was soon to become the king of Israel. But at this time, Saul was still the king. And Saul was going around trying to kill David, really, so that David wouldn't become the king instead of him. So that's what was going on at the time. And David was kind of keeping his distance from Saul, keeping at arm's length, but he knew where Saul was. And there was one day, in fact, there were 2 days on two different occasions where David found himself alone with Saul unarmed, David armed. So let me give you an example. There was an example when, and this is the example from 1 Samuel 24, that David was hiding in a cave. And Saul came into the cave, not knowing that David was there to relieve himself. And Saul was at David's mercy. It would have been a matter of seconds. He could have killed him. And David could quite easily have said, "He's been hunting me down. He's trying to take my life. I was acting in self-defense, David." Maybe could have tried to use those as an excuses, but they'd only have been excuses. And instead of that, he stayed his hand. He did not take Saul's life. He kept his soldiers back so that the soldiers that were with him didn't take Saul's life, because he knew it would have been the wrong thing to do. He was a man who was self-controlled. Now here's the remarkable thing, isn't it? Maybe you're surprised, some of you, that I chose David as an example of self-control. Isn't that surprising? And yet in this regard with Saul, not just once, twice, he was self-controlled. For those of you who don't know, why is it so surprising? Well, after David became king, 2 Samuel chapter 11, there was a very famous occasion where he completely lacked self-control. He saw Bathsheba bathing in a river. She was married to Uriah. And David essentially didn't care less about Uriah. He wanted Bathsheba for himself, and he took her. He ended up killing Uriah to get him out of the way. Do you see where self-control can lead? How destructive the lack of self-control is. Because here it was for David. It led him to adultery. It led him to murder. If you'd have asked him a few chapters earlier, "Do you think you'll become a murderer, David?" he would have said, "No way." But here's the frightening thing. In 1 Samuel 24, when it comes to Saul, he was full of self-control, a very model of self-control. But only a few chapters later, he was the very opposite. No self-control at all, just a glance from the rooftop, and he was lost. So what's the lesson there from David? Well, I think there are two lessons. The first lesson is that probably all of us have our weak spots, don't we? There may be some of us here this evening who in some areas are very strong, and areas where others would have great struggles, we would be able to stand strong and stand tall. And there's a danger associated with that, isn't there? That danger of pride. And maybe this is the second thing that we're taught of maybe from David's story. That if we're strong in certain areas, we can almost begin to think that we're invincible. And the problems that other people face are not problems that we face. But we realize very quickly that although we might be strong in one area where others are weak, then we ourselves are weak in areas where others are strong. And there are none of us who are strong in every area. Now, I don't know your weaknesses and you don't know mine, really. But the Lord knows, and I suspect you know your weaknesses very much, don't you? You know your weaknesses. And we need to be honest with ourselves and realize that none of us are immune to this. And it is a fight to be self-controlled. It is a fight to be self-controlled. As Joseph fled from Potiphar's wife, that was a fight, wasn't it? It wasn't necessarily an easy thing to do. As David had to physically restrain his men when Saul came into the cave, it could have turned into a physical fight, but it certainly was the emotional turmoil, fighting to do the right thing. It's not easy to do. While Cher and I were on holiday recently, we listened to an audio book of Jane Eyre, Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. Not my usual reading material, I have to confess, but don't tell Cher. And secretly, I quite enjoyed it. And for those of you who, like me a few weeks ago, had no idea what the plot of the story was, it's like many of the stories similar. It's a love story, essentially. But what happens here is that Jane Eyre, who's the main character, falls in love, and she later discovers that the person she's fallen in love with is married. He didn't tell her beforehand, but then he eventually admits that he's married. Well, he doesn't admit. Somebody tells her that he's married. And just at the moment when she's about to marry and she set her heart on this man and she finds out he's married. And he essentially says, look, don't worry about it. Come, be with me anyway. And because she's in love with him, she has this great fight in her inner being as to whether or not she should go with him as he's pleading for her to do, or whether she should do what she knows is right and not take the husband of another woman. And let me read to you some of what Charlotte Bronte writes as this pull, this inner fight. Maybe you can relate to it in some way. And she says this, in her being, almost as loud as feeling, there was this wild clamour. Comply, it said. Do it, in other words. Go with him. But still indomitable was the reply. I care for myself, she says. The more solitary, the more friendless, the more unsustained I am, the more I will respect myself. I will keep the law given by God and sanctioned by men. I will hold to the principles received by me when I was sane and not mad as I am now. Laws and principles are not for the times when there is no temptation. There are for moments as this, when body and soul rise in mutiny against their rigor. And she goes on to say this, I have always believed. And if I cannot believe it now, it's because I'm quite insane. Within my veins, running fire, my heart beating faster than I can count its throbs. Preconceived opinions, foregone determinations are all I have this hour to stand by. And there I plant my foot. Well, it's very picturesque language, isn't it? Maybe difficult to follow at points, but the main thrust is very clear, isn't it? And we had it, I will keep the law given by God and sanctioned by man. Or my feelings are taking me in one direction, she's saying. This fire running through my veins. But nonetheless, I will not bow to that. I will do what I know is right. That's what Joseph did in Genesis 39. It's what David did in 1 Samuel 24. And if you're to be someone who is self-controlled, it's what you and I must be. To say no to passions, to say no to those emotions that sometimes overwhelm us, and to do what we know is right. That's the practice of self-control. Well, we've seen the problem of self-control and the practice of self-control. And maybe for some of you, you're thinking, well, what about the impossibility of self-control? Well, that's not my final point. My final point is the possibility of self-control. You see, what I'm describing may seem impossible. It does to me as I've prepared. It does to me as I'm speaking. It seems impossible. We can do it sometimes, yes, but to do this always, to be self-controlled, even in the most difficult and tough situations, absolutely the Bible teaches us. We can and we must be self-controlled. So how then? How do we live in such a way? How are we able to be self-controlled? Well, in order to find that out, we have to go to the New Testament. And I do want you to turn this time to Titus chapter 2 on page 1059, because we're going to finish by looking at Titus 2 verses 11 to 12 that teaches us how we can be self-controlled. Here's what Paul says as he writes to Titus, a young man. Titus 2 verse 11, page 1059. For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that, denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age, looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us, that he may redeem us from every lawless deed, and purify for himself his own special people, zealous for good works. Well, what a great reminder that is from the Apostle Paul. What he's saying is this, I want you to be self-controlled. I want you, just as Jane Eyre did in that work, I want you to deny ungodliness and worldly lusts. I want you to say no to those things. whether that's sexual temptation, whether that's to do with food, whether it's to do with the things that we say, whether it's anger, whatever it might be, say no to those things. That's what Paul is saying. But crucially, vitally, he tells us how we can say no. There it is in verse 11. The grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us. Teaching us. The grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men. You see, if you want to be self-controlled, there's no way to be self-controlled outside of Titus chapter 2, verse 11. Outside of knowing the grace of God that brings salvation. Do you see what Paul is saying? If you're struggling with self-control, you need to be rescued. That's Paul's message. You need to be rescued. You need to be saved. And where do you go for that? Where do you go for that rescue and that salvation? If you're the city on a hill whose walls are already broken down, whether they're totally broken down as Jerusalem was, or maybe there's just one or two places where the enemy can get in. Probably most of us are in that situation. The wall is kind of up, but there are gaps in it. How can we be saved from the enemy? Well, it's the grace of God brings that salvation, and it's appeared to all men. And it teaches us to deny that. So what is the substance of this grace of God? Well, the very fact it's grace of God means it's a free gift that's freely offered, doesn't it? Not something that we work up in ourselves. Paul isn't saying here, try harder to do better. That's not his message. His message instead is in verse 13. What we need to do is to look for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. What can help you in self-control? Two things. You can remember what Jesus Christ has already done. You see, 2,000 years ago, Jesus Christ died on the cross in the place of sinners, didn't he? And what did he die for? Well, he died for all those times when you have lost your self-control. He died for all those times when you said things you knew were hurtful and wrong. He died for all those times when you did things that you knew you should never do. Jesus Christ died for our sin, the Bible says very clearly. He died for our sin. And as we remember what it cost him, as we look back at the cross, and we see that separation between him and his Father, my God, why have you forsaken me? When we see the pain and the anguish and the torment, and we realize that he chose to be there, there's no greater place to see self-control and there on the cross. Because although Jesus was nailed to the cross with nails through his hands and his feet, he tells us himself that he could have called down a whole legion of angels to bring him down from the cross, couldn't he? But he chose to stay there. It wasn't the nails that kept him there. It was his free choice. Because he knew that as he hung there, bleeding and dying, separated from his Father, he was doing it for people like us. He was doing it so that we could be free from sin and the consequences of sin. And for every one of us then, it's the grace of God that brings salvation as appeared to all men, that teaches us to deny godliness and worldly lust. We must look back to the cross and see what Jesus has done if we're to fight ungodliness and worldly passions. But there's something else that we're told here as well, isn't it? In verse 13, not just the looking back to Christ's appearing, but looking forward for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. You see, it's not just looking back at what Jesus has already done, but it's also looking forward and realizing that he's coming back. And time after time, the Bible tells us and teaching us, we must be ready. We must be ready for Christ's return. I wonder, are you ready for Jesus to come back? Because he is coming. And we're asked this question, aren't we, in the Bible? What will he find when he comes back? Let me ask you that question this evening. You don't have to answer out loud, but answer to yourself in your own mind. What will he find in your hearts, in your life, when he comes back? What will he find? You see, we're reminded here, aren't we? He gave himself for us, that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself his own special people. You see, the wonder of the gospel is not merely that we look to the cross and see what Christ has done and that spurs us on. It certainly does. But we realize that what happened at the cross actually changed something for those who are Christians, for those who have trusted in God. And what happened at the cross, as we're told here, was that we were redeemed from every lawless deed. And if you're a Christian here this evening, then that is true of you. Redeemed from every lawless deed. We no longer have to follow the things that Satan encourages to do. But we can say no to ungodliness and worldly passions. We can be self-controlled. Why? Because ourselves have died. And we're risen with Christ. That's the Bible metaphor, isn't it? And as his power works in us and through us, we can say no in a way that we would never be able to do were it not for Jesus Christ. But if you're not yet a Christian, then that's not yet true of you. That you can't deny ungodliness and worldly lusts. And your own experience teaches you that, doesn't it? That too many times you do what you know you ought not to do. What's the hope for you? Well, the only hope for you is the same as us. The only hope for you is that you come to the cross. You come to the place where Jesus died. And you realize that if you trust him, then he died for you. I wonder if you really believe that, that Jesus Christ died for you. Do you believe it? Because if our trust is in him, then he can cleanse us from all of our sin. Give us a new life and a new heart that we might live for him.